The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
The cops show up at the house behind my grandma, and he and his strange wife are both there. She has moved out, been back in the house for about 36 hours, and she's getting her stuff to take it off to Canada. And they're in the middle of a spat. And she accuses him, she accuses the cops, he's using drugs, he says she's drunk, and it's a very unhappy picture. The cops, trying to get to the bottom of it, turn to Scott and say, can we search the house? And Scott, the lawyer, says, without a warrant. And then they turn to his wife and say, can we search the house? And she says, yes, definitely. At this point, things have taken a turn for the worse for Scott, and she takes them up to the bedroom, and they find a straw with a substance that is alleged to be, and, well, to be honest, the lab report substance confirmed to be cocaine. The police charge him with possession of a substance. The trial court is the there's an immediate interlocutory appeal to the First Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court, both of which say, no, he objected, he has a Fourth Amendment right, they didn't have probable cause, and they didn't report. And so the search is invalid. The federal court of appeals has all come out the other way on the basis of two Supreme Court decisions. Those cases, the occupants were around, one case on the front lawn, another case was leaving the back bedroom. But the arguable distinction feature, and certainly the distinction of the question was a distinction with or without a difference, was that there was no objection to this case. There was one person who should search, and that was good enough for the Supreme Court. This case tests whether an objection was given to the search or with the search was given. And the Supreme Court granted cert to resolve that conflict. Most of it's a really interesting dynamic. Most of the state Supreme Courts hold that this is an unconstitutional claim, and that all of the federal courts hold that a citizen's question hold that it is a complete warrant. So that's the state election.
Alright, so at the top of the hour, the Chief Justice would have called the case, and the Assistant Attorney General from Georgia would have talked for probably 17 minutes and reserved 3, and then the Deputy Solicitor General would have done 10 minutes. They would have just sat down, and the Chief Justice would say, Mr. Goldstein, and...
And I might be, it would be terrific if I were in the position of standing up and saying, since we all know that Mr. Randolph's going to win, I have nothing to say. But in the event that it's actually necessary to answer some questions,
so
the perhaps more likely event.
Mr. Goldstein, you may proceed.
You're in the middle chair. Madam Chief Justice, and would that it were true, because Mr. Randolph made a contemporaneous objection, the warrantless search of his home violated his Fourth Amendment right to privacy. If this case merely involved Mrs. Randolph's consent, the state would win under Matlock, for reasons, however, that do not apply here. When one occupant consents, as in Matlock, the officers don't bear the impractical burden of tracking down all the other occupants. And residents of shared premises assume the risk, in the language of that case, that our co-occupants will freely let in others unless we speak up and object.
Mr. Goldstein, under the totality of the circumstances at the time, did the officers have a reasonable belief that Mrs. Matlock had the authority to grant consent for the search?
No, because one occupant with a Fourth Amendment privacy interest in the premises had objected to the search. That's an important point. The proper inquiry is to the totality of the circumstances, and there is a vital distinction between this case and Matlock and Rodriguez. The additional circumstances, the invocation of Fourth Amendment rights.
But the question is, did Mrs. Matlock have the authority to consent to the search of the premises?
In the Fourth Amendment sense, the answer to that question is no. In the sense of property rights, I also think the answer to that question is no.
But isn't it clear that at the time, from the record, at the time the police arrived, she had moved back into the house, she did have belongings in the house, they were a married couple and they had a child together. Knowing that information from the complaint she filed, didn't she have the authority as a co-occupant of that dwelling, at least at the time she gave consent, to authorize a consent to the premises?
Well, let me take both the premise and what legal conclusion follows from it. As to the premise, the officers were told that it was his bedroom, not hers. But as to the legal conclusion, this has to be considered, I think, under decisions like Kylo and lots of others that have said that the Fourth Amendment inquiry doesn't follow from the property rights inquiry. The question is whether someone has a constitutional privacy interest in the premises. And when he stated an objection, the officers knew that somebody with a protected privacy interest had invoked the Fourth Amendment, and as a consequence, they needed to go get a warrant, or if they wanted other forms of cooperation from her, to ask her to bring out whatever it was that caused her concern.
See, I don't understand that argument that you make, that she could have brought out this material to the police. I mean, I understand that, but then you're also making these arguments about privacy interests, and you're drawing upon that, your home is your castle, ideology behind the Fourth Amendment, and yet then you say she could have just brought out anything she wanted to the police. Doesn't that undermine your points about the privacy interests in your home?
I don't think so. It's true that the most protective rule of privacy would say that she couldn't even bring things out, but this court has held previously that you can cooperate with officers to that extent. There is a critical difference. It's not merely one of degree, but one of kind in a situation in which you bring something out versus allowing a search, because one involves a seizure of a particular item. It's apt to be an item that there's a reason to believe is contraband. This is a suspicionless, generalized search of the entire premises. That's a very different kettle of fish, particularly when it's of the home. Now, I had said that there were really two critical distinctions, and I want to focus on them for just a moment, but that is distinctions between this case and Matlock and Rodriguez. The first is that he had a personal right to privacy under this court's decision in Rakes that nobody else could waive. In Matlock and in Rodriguez, there is a risk that's undertaken that if you don't speak up, you know that someone else can be admitted to the premises. But it doesn't follow that you lose all of your Fourth Amendment rights merely by living with someone else.
But maybe I don't know the facts of Matlock well enough, but it seems that in Matlock, he was arrested and put into a police car. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, and I think it would be presumed he wouldn't have wanted his home searched, but they didn't ask him. So in this case, could they avoid the whole problem? And if you win, can police avoid the problem in the future by just simply arresting the person they know will object, putting them in a police car, asking the person who lives in the home, can we search? They don't have to go back and ask the guy in the police car, and then they always get their one person consenting, nobody objecting.
Well, the question has several different components. You described the facts of Matlock accurately, and if this case had presented a reprise of Matlock, although this question wasn't presented in Matlock, the question of what exactly it means that you take someone and put them away in a police car, I think considerations of administrability put the onus on the occupant to state an objection if they want to protect their privacy, because they have assumed some risk, this court said in Matlock, that their co-occupants will allow others in. Does it present a vehicle for circumventing the Fourth Amendment? Conceivably, if so, that's a reason for heightening the Constitution's protections, not lowering them.
But I'm a little confused. If Randolph had not been present and the police arrived in response to Mrs. Randolph's request for assistance, and she explained to them that there was cocaine or drug paraphernalia in the home, could she have consented to the police searching the premises?
Yes.
Well, if she could have consented when he wasn't there, in response to my earlier question, why is it she could not have consented and given valid consent while he was there?
Because the court's rationale in Matlock is that you assume certain risks. And the risk that you assume, and it's just a common sense proposition, if we're not at home, we know that people who live with us and are at home may admit others. It doesn't follow from that that we are powerless to protect our privacy when we are at home. One reason that sort of balances that risk with the reality that you're able certainly to protect your privacy when you're at home is that you expect your interests will be furthered and your desires will be honored by your co-occupants.
If the police arrived, Mrs. Matlock said, go ahead, search, and I'll show you where the cocaine is, and Mr. Matlock was there, Mr. Randolph was present and said nothing, and the police went in response to Mrs. Randolph's consent, would that have been a valid search?
Yes.
So the fact that he is there, just physically there, is not the constitutionally significant fact.
That's right.
It is the fact that he voiced concerns.
Voiced an objection.
So it seems to me you are conceding that Mrs. Randolph had the authority to grant consent in the absence of Mr. Randolph denying consent to search.
Catherine, let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you two questions because I may not get a chance to ask another. They have to do with two concepts that are pretty well established in Fourth Amendment law, as you agree. And one is the legitimate expectation of privacy, whether a person has a legitimate expectation of privacy. And two is something you've already talked about a lot, and that's assumption of risk. And courts talked about that. This court has addressed those issues in a number of different contexts. First question is, with regard to the legitimate expectation of privacy, isn't it true that anyone who lives with another person under any circumstances has a less of an expectation of privacy than if they live alone, and how does that affect your argument? And two, where has this court ever made the assumption of risk issue dependent upon the presence or absence of the non-consenting party?
Let me take them in reverse order if I could, because
okay.
The first answer is simpler. That phrase, assumption of the risk, comes from Frazier versus Kopp, is repeated in the Matlock case. And Frazier makes the critical point, which is again reiterated in Matlock, that the risk is assumed because in Frazier it was the duffel bag that was jointly owned, and he left the duffel bag in the possession of his co-occupant at the co-occupant's mother's house. And that was, in fact, the critical point that points up the risk that was taken. You left it in somebody else's control. They're going to do with it what they will. And Matlock says, again, after Frazier, that this court's precedents established that it's the absent, and by absent I take it to mean the person who isn't there and doesn't state an objection, it is the absent owner's risk that's assumed.
Wait a minute, let me add stuff right there, because if we're not talking about a duffel bag, we're talking about a house, right? I mean, there's always going to be some point in time when you're going to leave your house, right? You're not going to always be there. And doesn't that raise the issue of this sort of leaving this, you know, the fortuity of whether or not the non-consenting party is present or absent? Doesn't it also present some practical problems with regard to police officers timing their visits to the home when they know the person may or may not be there? And ought some concept that's important be dependent upon that fortuity?
Well, let me pause and say I think you are right to focus on questions of administrability. I think that's at the heart of the Matlock rule. We read Matlock to say, look, you show up, officers, and get permission from one occupant to search the house. You don't have to track down all the others. We're not going to put the burden on you of figuring out who lives there, finding them, calling them, and asking them for permission to search. That's why the search in Matlock is perfectly reasonable from an administrability point of view. It does not follow, however, if someone stands on the threshold and says, I live here, I have a protected privacy interest, and it's a personal privacy right under Rakes versus Illinois, I'm invoking it. Now, you raise the further question, and that's the flip side. Is there a concern, however, that our rule would invite gamesmanship by the police? I would only say as a threshold matter that if this is a genuine concern, it's the second time the court has raised the question of whether the police will try and circumvent the Fourth Amendment. If that is the court's perspective, then it needs to be more protective, not less protective of the Fourth Amendment. But the indistinguishable incentive exists under either side's rule. Remember, the state says that they can get permission from someone who's a non-target, and if that rule is accepted, then they'll simply wait for a non-target to show up at the house, whereas under our rule, there might be an incentive to avoid when the target is there. I think they're indistinguishable.
Is your rule that if the two people who own the house and live in the house are there, that the police not only at least one person have to object, but the police should ask both of them?
No.
But then if your rule isn't that the police have to ask both of them, it's clear what's going to happen. And you're going to tell me that this is because the police are trying to subvert the Fourth Amendment, but I'm just telling you what's going to happen. They're going to separate the two, and they're going to ask the person they think is going to consent, can we search?
I can only say that that is not what experience shows. Officers tend simply to ask the people that they run into. There are too many cases to count in which the targets of the search are asked for permission to search, and that's true here. But remember that if we are concerned about the inevitable consequences of either side's rule, that is certainly a point that favors us. The state's rule is that you can show up at a house that has 9 residents, and you can ask one, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another, all of whom invoke their Fourth Amendment right to privacy, until you find someone finally who doesn't understand their rights and consents to the search. That flies in the face of common sense, and it flies in the face of...
Yeah, but the rule is 8 people consent and 1 person doesn't, and you can't search.
So that is not necessarily the case. It is an open question whether you can search. What is certainly true under our rule is that you can't admit the fruits of the search against a person who has invoked the Fourth Amendment without complying with the Fourth Amendment. You need to have a warrant that's evaluated by a magistrate. If the 8 people say the 9th person is using drugs, seal the premises and go get a warrant on the basis of the first-hand testimony of 1 or 6 or 8 of the co-residents, the magistrate will be able to evaluate whether there's reason to believe that there's probable cause. The problem is on the other side, when there's no reason to have any suspicion whatsoever. We're talking about as intrusive a search as you can possibly imagine, going through every room, breaking into the attic, every possible computer file, including because the people in the house are just in the middle of a fight, and one is trying to disadvantage another and inconvenience another.
Mr. Wolfson, can I ask you a series of questions? You seem to be putting all your weight on the objection by Mr. Randolph.
Yeah.
Not his presence, but his specific objection. Can I give you a series of cases in analogous circumstances and see how that plays out? Because you seem to be saying that where there would otherwise be a third-party consent exception to the warrant requirement, that can be stopped if the person whose privacy is being invaded objects. Let me start with a non-Fourth Amendment context. And we're talking about spouses here, so it's estranged spouses, but both of whom have control over common areas of the house. I presume that's what we're talking about. They're estranged in large part because they hate one another's friends, okay? And the husband's friend comes by one night and wants to sit around drinking beer with the husband in the living room, and the wife doesn't want the friend to be there, and she raises her objection to the husband. I don't want Mr. Smith here. The husband, I take it under general property law rules, can nevertheless invite the friend in to view the premises and to sit there and drink beer, correct?
Yes, but can I explain why I think that's distinguishable?
Sure.
Okay.
Then I'll go on to my next.
Sure, I'm sure you will, but let me explain why I think there are two important differences. The first is that under Minnesota versus Carter, the question isn't whether you have the right to keep the person out, but whether you have an expectation that your wishes will be honored. And Minnesota versus Carter says that in that case, it's the overnight guest who has no authority to keep anybody off the premises whatsoever. But Minnesota versus Carter says, and Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Minnesota versus Olson later reiterates, that we have a social expectation that when two co-occupants disagree about whether someone should come in, the objection will be honored.
By
the person who, the wishes of the person who wants to keep people out will be honored. And so even though it's maybe technically true as a matter of property law, in your hypothetical, the wife could admit the police, that's not the relevant Fourth Amendment question. The question is, what is your expectation? The second distinction is that it makes all the difference in the world when you're talking about somebody inviting somebody over to drink beers and watch television, and you're talking about having the police over to root through the closets and the computer files and initiate a criminal prosecution. That's what the Fourth Amendment protects against. There is no Fourth Amendment right to keep out your wife and your husband's dumb friend.
No, I know that. I'm not suggesting there's a Fourth Amendment right. I'm suggesting that there's a very significant lowered expectation of privacy because by marrying the person and becoming a joint tenant of the home with them, you've consented to have strangers who you hate see everything that's there in the common living areas.
The only thing I can say about that is that you can't equate a reduced expectation of privacy in the sense of your co-occupants and their friends will see something, with the expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the police. The government is just a very different animal when it comes to being able to come into the house, search through things, and initiate a criminal prosecution.
Well, that's a good segue into my next series of questions, because I mean, I think the Fourth Amendment law is generally the other way, that the more you take risks that make yourself, your privacy open to others, private parties, the less expectation of privacy you have vis-a-vis authority. So let me give you other examples of consent. The jailhouse snitch case, right? Let's say you're with your cellmate, the cellmate's been turned by the police, unbeknownst to you, and is going to snitch, and you start every conversation by saying, you know, in case you're a snitch, I want to state right here on the record, into the microphone that you might be wearing, that I don't consent to the use of this conversation by the police. Or you give your records to your bank, and the bank can consent to turning over your financial records to the government under our case law. What if you put on every page, I do not consent to my records being turned over? Those, I mean, you can imagine hypotheticals being spun out over and over, so that an objection will get defendants out of all of these general third-party consent rules.
I don't mean to pause, but you haven't asked a question.
No, go ahead.
My reaction?
Sure.
Thankfully for us and for the Fourth Amendment, this court in Gotti distinguished those cases from one that involves the search of the home. If you take information and give it to a third person, if that person gives it to the police, that's not a search. This is a very different animal. The analog is the one that I started out with. I know you were late in traffic. Getting downtown is hard.
But I know better how you think, sir.
If his wife had taken materials from the home that she had seen and given them to the police, that might be a different question. But if you were to extend cases like White and Gotti to this context, take the case that says if one person to a phone conversation consents, the police can listen in. This is a search. And it's a search of an area that in which the consenting party may have no particularly detailed knowledge and certainly isn't in. The analogy would be saying that a person in the home can consent to tapping a telephone conversation when they aren't even on the call. That's the difference, is that this is not a piece of information.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction. Let's take your phone call case, right? One of the parties to the call consents to having the police tap it.
Yes.
The other party, the suspect,
right, says
at the outset of the conversation, in case this is tapped,
yes,
I do not consent to the police's overhearing my conversation. Does that get out? What's the answer to that?
That's unsettled, but I'm willing to assume that the Fourth Amendment still wouldn't prohibit it. You're taking a risk there. Again, it hasn't been settled by this court. People just generally don't start conversations like that.
No, but if we announced your rule in this case...
No, our rule does not carry with it the consequence that would violate the Fourth Amendment. And the very significant difference is that this is a search of the home, not a sharing of information with a third person. To the extent one says that something was shared here in the sense that she had seen the drugs, she could pick the drugs up and give them to the police. What she could not consent to is a generalized search of the premises. If that consequence follows from White and cases like it, then a resident of the home can consent to tapping any phone call in the house, because they might pick up an extension, can consent to any phone call even if they're not participating in it. Gotti draws a firm line and says, look, there's a world of difference between sharing information with another person who might then turn it over to the police, there's no search at all, and allowing searches of the home. Remember, while it's certainly the case that it's an intuitive matter, we have less privacy when we live with other people. But that fact does not live in tension with the bedrock principle of the Fourth Amendment, and that is the home is core area protected by the Fourth Amendment.
But I'm still trying to figure out the ramifications of your rule and how it's going to play out in real life. Could somebody like Mr. Randolph, who's a lawyer and knows his rights, put a sign on his door so that even when he's not there, the sign says, police, even if my wife consents to search, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, under your rule, that would be one way in which even when you're not present or the police try to pull you off, you can always have your lack of consent there.
Sure. Illinois versus Rodriguez says it would depend on whether the officers had a reason to believe that it wasn't some sort of joke. We don't really see those signs very often. But if a reasonable officer would look at that and say, wow, somebody has a lot of foresight, That's someone protecting their Fourth Amendment right to privacy, because the administrability concern that exists in Matlock and Rodriguez doesn't exist there.
So in Matlock, if Mr. Matlock, while he was being forced into the police car, had said, "I don't give you consent to search my home," the case would have come out the other way.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Is it constitutionally significant that the police went in with the wife's consent, saw some incriminating information, left to get bags to secure the evidence, and before they returned to the house, she withdrew her consent? Is that factually correct?
It's nearly factually correct. They left when she kicked them out.
But they returned to retrieve the items.
Yes.
And before they returned, she withdrew the consent. It was clear that she no longer consented. And is it constitutionally significant that the second time that they entered the premises without a warrant and actually retrieved the incriminating items, they were doing so without a warrant and without anyone's consent?
Well, let me just specify the facts so that we're all on the same page. She consents after he objects and after the homeowners object. The police officers go up, they see the materials. She then withdraws her consent. They leave to go downstairs and come back upstairs and get an evidence baggie. The argument was not preserved below whether that constituted some further search. I expect if it had been preserved, a court would have said, look, it's in plain view. They saw it while they had a reason to believe that they were there. I do think the points you make, however, do have some constitutional significance. The first is that people can object and withdraw their consent, and that's what he did in the very first instance. He objected and preserved his right to privacy. The second is that it may well be that by her consenting, if those had been her drugs, they would have been admissible against her. Our point is not that a person can't cooperate and allow the police insofar as their own privacy rights are involved. Our point instead is that if you want to search against someone who has invoked the Fourth Amendment tells you to go get a warrant. And when you have a cooperating co-occupant, we know that you'll have evidence that you can take to them.
Mr. Randolph, could he have brought a Bivens action against the police, even if they couldn't use the evidence against him? Wouldn't it still be an unconstitutional search under your view?
Yes. I don't know if they hadn't found anything, what damages would have been involved, which is why the court has so rigorously preserved the exclusionary rule. But that's true. The search would have invaded his privacy in all events.
So you're saying that they could have used the evidence against her, and that's fine. You still have to acknowledge under your rule they would have violated the Constitution such that he could have brought a damages action against
her. That's true, although Rakes versus Illinois and its progeny involve lots of times where there's a search of a particular premises, evidence is admissible against one person and not another, and the person against whom it's inadmissible could also bring a Bivens action or some sort of...
Mr. Goldstein, you've talked enough number of times about administrability, but it seems to me that you're imposing an enormous practical burden on the police in this situation, and that the administrability argument cuts the other way, that we ought to give the police the discretion and the leeway to be able to act in a practical way in the circumstances and not to have to sort out who's who and which party really has the authority to consent and who doesn't.
Well, Your Honor, I simply disagree. Our rule is that if somebody who officers have reason to believe has a privacy interest in a space objects to the search, you can't search unless you get a warrant. The other side's rule does create, I think, a level of administrative problems, and that is weighing the relative privacy interests of two parties in the premises. And our fundamental point about administrability is that's really what makes this case different from Matlock and Rodriguez. In Matlock and Rodriguez, you couldn't have expected the police to bear the burden of tracking down all the residents. And so that it followed that there's a common sense rule. If somebody wants to protect their privacy in a shared space, say something. Otherwise, we all understand that our co-occupants may end up admitting the police. I also want to return to the point that I was making about how this really is at the heart of the Fourth Amendment, and you can't say realistically that by living together in a home, you are undercutting your Fourth Amendment rights. Remember that at the time the Fourth Amendment was framed, 98.7% of the American population lived with other people in their homes. That's still true of three-quarters of the population. It's also the poorest population that can afford to live in separate spaces where you're more likely to have people living together. And it seems to me that the essence of the state's position is that if you want to protect your privacy, you're going to have to live apart from other people. And that flies in the face of the constitutional right to privacy, the strongest textual foundation of the notion that we have personal relationships protected from the government that we want to encourage in the home rather than to break them up, is the Fourth Amendment. And that's what the framers wanted. They wanted us to have a sense of peace and security, which is the term that's in the Fourth Amendment.
But as a factual matter, it's pretty clear from the record developed below that Mr. and Mrs. Randolph did share the bedroom where the items, the incriminating information was recovered. Isn't that correct?
No, actually, the reverse is true. She told the police when the officers were going upstairs that it was his bedroom.
So is it your contention that even if he was not present at the time and did not voice objections, that she could not have consented to a search of his private bedroom?
It would have depended under Illinois versus Rodriguez what the officers knew. If they said, this is my estranged husband's bedroom, not mine, and so the officers understood that it was a distinct space. For example, he had a law office.
I understand that, but under the facts developed here, you conceded earlier that had he not been present, or if he was present and silent, that she would have been able to invoke a valid consent to the search. So you're implicitly conceding that this was not a private set-aside bedroom that could not have been searched.
Yes, and let me explain the distinction in the answers. One was sort of what's the legal consequence in this case. That's because the argument was not preserved below that she did not have authority. Your second question, what is true as a matter of fact? As a matter of fact, the officers were told that it was his bedroom. I do think the fact, however, has an important consequence, and that is that the state's rule draws officers into all kinds of disputes, not just marital disputes and family disputes and disputes among co-occupants and roommates, but disputes about sort of relative strength of privacy interests in space. Our rule says as long as the officers know that somebody has a privacy expectation in a particular room or in the house, they live there, the Fourth Amendment tells you to go get a warrant, and there's no administrative burden there, and it protects the core of the Fourth Amendment's right to privacy.
I think I'm going to be not asking a question but looking for your reactions again, but is there any distinction to be drawn between two people that are married versus roommates, or you know, a hotel or some place where you can accept guests? It seems to me that when you say this rule that the state is seeking here will compromise your privacy, it seems to me like, no, it won't. It'll only compromise your privacy if your spouse and you aren't on the same page about your privacy. And it seems to me that you maybe a lot of your rights end up being things that are shared, or that you put at risk certain things that aren't at risk when you're not married. You know, you take on debt jointly, things like that.
Why?
So maybe the fact they're married should have some effect in this case.
Well, I think it does, but in the sense that this court's decisions about marriage do rest as a textual matter on the protections of the Fourth Amendment, and we shouldn't have a rule that causes it to be torn apart. With respect to whether in general it would make a difference between a married couple versus a roommate versus an overnight guest, I think the answer to that comes from Illinois versus Rakes. And then when you use the phrase other times when you have joint or shared rights that one may sacrifice for the other, that may well be true, but of course the critical point is that this is not a joint or shared right. Rakes versus Illinois says it was his right. It is not one that he shared with anyone else. That's an argument and a doctrine that the government argued for decades, so that they could admit evidence against one person and not against another when the first person didn't have a Fourth Amendment right. And the upshot of it, if this court is going to adhere to that doctrine, is that his right couldn't be waived by somebody else. It wasn't something that they were sharing. They lived in the same space, but they had an independent right.
This is sort of a purple question, but let's say there were four adults and a child, a 12-year-old child present, who lives in the house. Is your view that the child could object to the search?
Our view is that the child could object to the search so long as they had a privacy interest in the premises. The important part of your hypothetical, I think, is that the state's position is that it's the four adults, including all the property owners, objected, and the child consented because she was in a spat with her parents. The search is valid, and the courts of appeals that adopt the state's rule all have reached that conclusion.
Let me just note that the time has expired, but we're happy to keep going for a few more minutes if there are more questions.
I wanted you to go back to the expectations of privacy argument. I know you rely a lot on Matlock's dicta about assumptions of risk, and that depends on whether someone is present or absent when you're talking about a co-occupant situation. But why is it not the case that you have a reduced expectation of privacy, whether or not you're married, whenever you share any house with other roommates, spouses, children? You've already said that one way to expose yourself to officers is if your roommate or spouse takes evidence into police officers. Clearly, you're assuming some risks when you undertake illegal activity in a private residence where other people can allow, you allow other people access to this, illegal activity.
Yes. That's the case. That if, and remember, of course, that the state's rule has nothing to do with illegal activity. It could be the most legal thing in the world, that, and with no suspicion whatsoever, that the police are allowed to come in. So I don't think that should sort of bias the outcome of the case or the hypothetical. It's true that if I show something to someone else, they can then tell the police. That's not a search by the police. The court has also said that if they, someone can pick it up and give it to the officers, that's cooperation. It's perfectly valid. That's why our rule doesn't undercut law enforcement.
Right.
But it doesn't follow from that that you give up all your privacy in the home. The heart of the Fourth Amendment is the home, and it doesn't mean that that person who happens to have been in the residence can just allow the cops to come in. If it were actually the case that the reduced expectation of privacy that follows from the fact that I live with my wife means that I have a reduced expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the police, then the police wouldn't need anybody's consent at all. The upshot of a doctrine that says there's a reduced expectation of privacy is that the police can come in on sort of a Terry standard or on no suspicion whatsoever. It doesn't bear any relationship to the fact that there was a consent to the search. A reduced expectation of the privacy just means that the normal strictures of the Fourth Amendment don't apply at all.
No adequate expectation of privacy. Reduced could be somewhere on a continuum between.
Well, the court would be making up more new doctrine than I can really keep track of, because there isn't a situation that I know of that says that, you've reduced it just enough so that it so happens. I mean, this would just be, we're trying to come up with the rules to let the government win. I don't think that ought to be the object of the court here. We are, dead in
sense. No, I don't think that. I think it's consistent with the line of cases with the other consent, third-party consent cases.
But, Your Honor, what you're now characterizing as a third-party consent case isn't. A case like the Penn Register case or the Banks case is not a third-party consent case. And the court has said that in the further extension of that doctrine that says that one person can allow the government to listen in on a conversation, that's just the best evidence rule. Because the individual could later describe the conversation to the police, we will allow the police to listen in and know exactly what happened on the call. The court's third-party consent cases are cases like Chapman and Stoner, and the heart of those cases is this court's holding that says, look, if anybody else has the power to waive your right to keep out the government, you have no right to keep out the government. It is totally ephemeral if you are powerless to control your own expectations of privacy in the home. And that is the upshot of the state's rule. There is nothing that you can do.
I'm not saying it's doctrinally on all fours. I'm simply saying that in those cases, there's some notion that your expectation of privacy is lowered somewhat, so that if you're on a phone call with someone, the fact that you make phone calls and thereby lower your expectation of privacy to the extent that if that other person consents, the police can listen in, doesn't mean that you lose all of your privacy in all of your phone calls, because there's always that possibility. Similarly here, your expectation isn't that the police will come in at any time. It's that your spouse might occasionally allow the police in over your objection in very rare cases.
Well, remember, the state's rule is in every case. It's whenever the person happens to consent. And the real problem when it comes to the sense of security and privacy we have is that it could happen at any time when we're in the middle of.
But you keep saying it could happen at any time, it could happen in any case. It only happens when the person you live with chooses to let the police in. That's what bothered me reading your brief. It's always that you let someone in your house who then consents. And that's where you had some control and some choice, who you chose to marry, who you chose to move into your house.
Well, if that is the upshot of Matlock, then the Fourth Amendment is in serious trouble. If we have to divorce our spouses and leave our children in order to have the sense of security that the Fourth Amendment commands, other than getting a warrant.
No, just persuade them to be loyal to you.
Just have a conversation.
Mr. Goldstein, I'm concerned about, the Mrs. Randolphs of the world who had the misfortune of marrying criminals, and all those poor people that you were talking about before who have the misfortune of living with criminals, and they can't move because they can't afford to move. What about their rights? I mean, we all have constitutional rights. We all have Fourth Amendment rights. We can all certainly choose to give up those rights. And if we rule as you ask us to do, aren't we basically saying that, the Mrs. Randolphs of the world don't have the right to give up their Fourth Amendment rights when they want to, especially in a situation like this where they have the misfortune of being with someone who they know is engaged in criminal activity and they want to separate themselves from that person? As a policy matter, don't we want to encourage that behavior rather than discourage it or even prevent it by ruling as you ask us to do?
The answer to all of the questions, I think, is no. But let me explain them in these terms, and that is, you have a right to keep out the police. This court has said many times that the right to do something doesn't carry with it the right to insist on the opposite. You have no right to bring the police into the house if somebody has a Fourth Amendment interest. Now, it is certainly the case that we want to encourage cooperation with the police consistent with the Constitution. So, if you want to let someone into the house and the evidence is admissible against you, that's fine under our rule. If you want to cooperate by bringing something out, if you want to cooperate by giving them a statement that can be used with a magistrate, if you want to insist that the house be sealed while the police go to the magistrate, all of those things are fine. They're what the Constitution calls for. What the Constitution doesn't call for is that when, in a consent search, of course, there can be no suspicion whatsoever. You can be entirely unaware of your rights. And under the state's rule, every other person in the house can object to the search, and yet one person allows them in. I agree that there needs to be a balance, but the balance is the one that's actually dictated by the Constitution, and that is we can go to the magistrate, and we can allow police cooperation that way, and you can, in fact, bring out evidence. But it doesn't require as a consequence that if someone who has a privacy interest in the home invokes it and says, look, you're the government, I'm the individual, if you have no probable cause, this is my private space. It's the home. It's the heart of the Fourth Amendment.
But that's your problem. It wasn't his private space. It was hers, too. It was their private space that they shared together.
It was his right. Each of them had, under Rakes versus Illinois, and as I said, this is a doctrine that has saved the government in innumerable cases, it was his Fourth Amendment right. It was one that she could not waive. It's true that she was going to be in the space, but she had no right to insist that the government would be in the space. The Fourth Amendment resolves that tension by saying, we will ask the magistrate first.
So what you're arguing for is a rule that would simply state, if two people are co-occupants in a private dwelling and one of the occupants consents to a search, what the officers recover can only be used against the occupant who consented, and the non-consenting occupant who expressly voiced their refusal to give consent, although the police find evidence in the joint common areas of the house where they lawfully have the right to be pursuant to the consenting occupant's consent, that evidence cannot be used against the non-consenting person.
And they're not there lawfully, because you've agreed the non-consenting person can bring a Bivens action.
Yes, this is the upshot of Rakes and all of its progeny. It is the case that the police will frequently search one place and the evidence will be admissible against one person for they have no privacy interest or they've waived their privacy interest. That's what consent to search is. They waive their privacy interest in the space. Evidence could be admissible against them, and yet it won't be admissible against someone else whose Fourth Amendment rights have been violated.
But that search is illegal.
With our position.
The search of the consent of the space that's jointly owned is unconstitutional. Right? Even when one person consents.
As to one person. That is the doctrine of Rakes. You can have multiple people with distinct privacy interests in one space. You can't just call the search legal or illegal in the abstract. It's legal as to one person and not another.
But it was not constitutional for them to go in and search. You were saying you find evidence, it's admissible against the person who consented, but that was not a constitutional search because at the same time that you found that evidence that's admissible against the consenting person, you violated someone else's constitutional rights.
You can't, under this court's doctrine, you can't accurately describe the events and the legal consequence of the events that way. And that is, it is legal as to one person and illegal as to another. You can't. It's just not in the abstract, legal or illegal. That's the fundamental holding of Reagan.
Well, the constitutional violation would occur when they sought to use the fruits of the search against the non-consenting party. As long as they did not seek to do that, and they're only using it against the consenting party, Mr. Randolph's rights would not have, constitutional rights would not have been violated.
No, that's not correct. There are two ways of enforcing the Fourth Amendment. One is the exclusionary rule, and one is through a civil rights suit. And so even if no evidence was admitted, that's why the Fourth Amendment protects people even when there's no evidence found and no trial. You can sue the government for barging through the front door even if they never criminally prosecute you.
So I'm just trying to make this clear. It's been many years since I've read Rakes.
Yep.
The search, as I understand it, maybe I've got your position wrong. The search here was legal as to Mrs. Randolph and illegal as to Mr. Randolph.
Yes.
Therefore, because it was illegal in part, the police should not have done it, right? They violated the Constitution.
They violated his constitutional rights.
Correct, and therefore it was unlawful for them to do it.
As to him?
No, I mean they have an obligation to abide by the U.S. Constitution. They violated the U.S. Constitution.
That's absolutely right, but I'm not making up some artificial phony distinction. This court held in Reagan.
We made it up.
at the government's urging. It was made up by
But your answer to Justice Davis's question was, in part, somebody could still waive their own right, and the police can search and introduce evidence against them. But they can't do that. That is violating the Constitution to do that when somebody else owns the home and expressly said don't search.
Again, it's very hard to know what you mean by saying they can't. The police would be liable to another person if there were some sort of damage for it. But the upshot of Rakes is that you can have a search that violates some people's constitutional rights and not others. And if their concern was getting evidence and admitting it against her, then they were perfectly free to do so. That's the consequence of our position. It would be consistent for the police to have conducted the search and admitted the evidence against a person who waived their Fourth Amendment rights. It may not be wise, and if it's not wise, then go get a warrant, because that person who has objected has a Fourth Amendment privacy interest. If the upshot of our position is that the police will be deterred from not going to magistrates when someone is trying to invoke the Fourth Amendment and they have the right to do so, that's hardly an unbearable consequence.
So if they found in the search marijuana that belonged to her and cocaine that belonged to him, there would be no problem with them prosecuting her for possession of marijuana?
Yes.
Even though it was the fruit of a search that was unconstitutional.
Again, that formulation doesn't track this court's decisions. It was the fruit of a search that was unconstitutional as to one.
And so they could prosecute her for marijuana possession, and yet he could sue under 1983, assuming there were damages.
Yes, she waived her rights. That's what consent is. Schneckloth says that. Zapp says that. She waived her Fourth Amendment rights. She has no right to sue anybody. She told the police it was fine to do.
On that note, thank
well,
you very much.
We have one more.
One more question.
It's more advice than a question. I think that there's kind of a tension in the brief. You're a bit hyperbolic in talking about the consequences of the state winning this case when you say that it will result in a pervasive sense of insecurity. I think just factually, probably, in most situations where you have co-occupants, there's going to be more trust. And this might be a relatively rare set of circumstances where you have, a wife and a husband who are in the midst of a divorce or roommates who hate one another. And the reason why I don't think that the consequences of the state winning are going to be so horrendous is that there are plenty of alternatives available to officers. If one resident of the home is interested in poking around some drawers and taking out some incriminating evidence and taking it to the police station, signing an affidavit, they can get a warrant and go back. And you already said that would be one of the ways that the state can legitimately get around your preferred result, which is go get a warrant. So I just don't think the consequences of the state winning this argument about consent are so dire.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that the end of the world is upon us. I do think that it's important to remember that this doesn't have to have anything to do with being in a fight. The police, when they ask for somebody to consent, don't have to say that they have the right to say no. And what it can equally turn on is just plain ignorance. The cops can ask somebody, they say no, they say, okay, go stand over here. Now let me ask your roommate. Mm-hmm. And then they can say to the roommate, look, can we come in? And that person says, no. And they say, really? You don't want to cooperate? Well, let me ask your other roommate. And they feel like the cops are then going to, you know, have now suspect them of having something to hide. And so it really doesn't turn on there in an unusual circumstance of there being a fight. The second thing is that your premise that there is trust should mean that we win. Because when I said to Marty that the question is, what is our reasonable expectation? What do we think will probably happen? Yeah, on your view that people really expect their co-occupants to respect their rights, we don't expect the scenario that happened mm-hmm. here to occur, and that is that we say we want to keep the police out, and our roommate thumbs their nose at us. And so there's an expectation of privacy. So we ought to be able to turn that argument.
Well, there's a general expectation, but you might expect that that estranged spouses who are at each other's throats will act quite differently.
But thankfully, the rule doesn't vary based on how
well they're
going. How's marital counseling going? And
all right, why don't we offer some feedback if you have it. For the audience, let me just introduce the justices, Professor Angela Davis, Professor Linda Dodd, Professor Amanda Frost, Professor Cynthia Jones, I'm Steve Wormeal, and Marty Lederman is an appellate lawyer in private practice and former Justice Department.
I'm teaching now.
Teaching. Okay, I apologize. Professor Marty Lederman.
Before we do feedback, can I just ask that if you would keep following question in mind in giving feedback. First, recognize that I have a sort of fragile disposition I may break down. But
I think you need to man up then before you go before the Supreme Court. They're tougher than we are.
The question I have is this one about, do we say the cops weren't allowed in, which is a simpler rule, or do we say, no, the cops could come in, and as to a person who waives their Fourth Amendment rights, the evidence is admissible about them. We're not stopping them from cooperating with the police to that extent. That is, in the brief, we don't expressly address it. To the extent we suggest one way or the other, we suggest that the cops have to stay out. That rule is more protective of mm-hmm. privacy. Mm-hmm. It is an ironic thing that you would say, we're trying to protect the private space, but, oh, yeah, the cops can come into it. It's just they can't admit the evidence. So I'm very interested in your views about that.
No, I think your position is that they can't come in, but they can nevertheless introduce the evidence against her.
No, they can. Our position would have to be that they can come in, otherwise there is no evidence.
But you're saying it violates the Constitution for them to.
I mean, I can only give the answer that I did before. Rakes versus Illinois doesn't have this concept of violating the Constitution. There are people who have privacy rights. The Fourth Amendment applies to persons, not places. And so they would come in and violate one person's Fourth Amendment rights, but not another person's Fourth Amendment rights who've waived them. So it isn't. It's true they would be violating someone's constitutional rights, but that happens in Fourth Amendment cases all the time under Rakes.
You know, one of the things that I thought about when I was looking at your brief and at the government's brief is this totality of the circumstances, whether the police officer, a reasonable police officer, I think I should say a reasonable man in the police officer's position, would have believed under the totality of the circumstances that the consent was valid. And what weight the fact that he was right there saying no before she said yes, what weight that should be given in the totality of the circumstances. And if that should be given some weight, then perhaps it begins to look a lot like no reasonable officer could believe that they had the legal authority to enter.
Doesn't Illinois versus Rodriguez say as soon as he came in the room and said no, they had to stop, but they had already seen some things?
No.
It doesn't say that?
He never said no.
Oh, he never said no. Oh, he was unconscious, wasn't he?
Well, he woke up.
But what if someone in the middle of one of these Illinois versus Rodriguez apparent consent situations, what if someone came into the room and said, no, I didn't consent to this. Do they have to stop right there? What would be the approach that you would take?
Okay. Yeah, just like she stopped in the middle here.
So I don't know how you can spin that out, but I think that if you're trying to homogenize and you think you do a very good job of trying to reconcile these facts and make them fit with Supreme Court cases, as you definitely need to do, you can simply say you haven't confronted this scenario, but when you throw that into the totality of the circumstances mix, no reasonable officer at that point could think, I have the authority to go in and search, when I have one person saying, absolutely not, you cannot search, and the other person saying, yes. It's like, weigh it all together, we're going to go search. I mean, that doesn't seem reasonable. And that's sort of a simpler way, so the court doesn't have to sort of navigate its way through Ratkus and all the other cases.
Well, I really agree with that, including both because it's simpler and because it's sort of the core Fourth Amendment formulation.
Mm-hmm.
You would say, you know, it makes no sense to say that it makes no difference whatsoever. In a doctrine that says we're going to look at the totality of the circumstances, it makes no difference whatsoever if somebody who has a privacy interest expressly invokes it and tells the cops
right.
to stay out.
And you have a way for the court to even limit the effects of this case by simply saying you have a clearly estranged wife who's called the police and said, my husband and I aren't getting along and he's taking the child. So they knew about all of that animosity and all of that in advance. Something else to take into account in the totality of the circumstances when
right.
she's giving consent. That might not be the case when, you know, an informant says, a guy in there selling drugs, and I come to the door and I say to the guy who answers the door, can I search? And he says, yes. I have no reason to believe that he doesn't have his authority. That's a very different factual scenario. So they don't have to come up with a rule that covers every roommate scenario and every... This is just when the police know there's animosity, they know that's an estranged wife, they know all this, and the person says no.
You know, there are a couple of things. One, two things, I guess. One is I found the argument that I found that might be persuasive to some of the justices that you're going to pick before is when you start talking about the founders and when you start talking about, you know, people living together and what the founders may have perceived and how this discourages, you know, that concept. I think that argument would be appealing because I do think, you know, this problem of assumption of risk that you have is sort of from White in that context all the way through here, which is there. The other thing, too, is that, you know, the court said, you know, in Ohio versus Robinette and all these other cases, you know, we're not going to tell police officers that they have to inform people of their rights. So it just would be sort of ironic, just cruel irony that in one of the very few cases when someone actually knew they had a right not to consent and asserts it, that it means nothing, you know? So I would try to make that point in light of the court's rulings regarding that. If there's going to be anything at all left to the right to refuse consent, then it's got to be this.
Right. The court has said that there's a, in one of the Florida, I think Bostick, that there is a distinct social interest in people expressing their consent or objection and officers adhering to it.
There you go.
I'm going to have to leave in a second, so I just thought I'd give my feedback. First, for your fragile ego, I thought you were great. and I also thought, just to tell the students, that he's also being a bit of a stand-up comedian, which one would not be for the actual
right.
Supreme Court. But it's just us, so that's fine. And the other thing I wanted to say, just in terms of your specific question about do you say the police are actually affirmatively allowed to go in, I think you can tell from my responses, I don't think you should say that, or if you do, you need to have a better answer to the problem. How could they write an opinion that says, in response to concerns raised by Angela, well, it's okay, the police can come in and search just for the purposes of finding evidence against the person who consented. They can't encourage that or say that's okay, when at the same time you have to concede a Section 1983 or Bivens action could be brought against them, right?
Right.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
No,
but if that's
unconstitutional,
then...
It's conceivable the rule should be that the police should win the Bivens action because someone had waived their rights and so they had authority to be in there. But, you know, more and more we're collapsing down into sort of a nothing of a privacy interest.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the cops can go in and it's perfectly fine except for just so long as my client gets out.
Yeah, it hurts your point about the home is your castle and it's private, which is already a little bit undermined by the fact the individual can take the evidence out.
Yeah.
You don't want to undermine it anymore. That's my view.
Right.
So.
And I assume that we agree on the can take the evidence out. We say it once in our brief, but then I say it multiple times in the argument. We think that we're trying to give people who are concerned about law enforcement interests the sense that this is not going to be a problem in cases where it really matters.
Yeah.
I assume we should stick with that.
Well, that was one of my two concerns. I mean, as you could tell, my two big concerns are one is this whole line of cases about most of which are about providing evidence that you've turned over to a third party. But then there's the third part. Then there's the phone call case as well, which is hard to deal with. And your brief is really good at trying to distinguish those, because those are hard, and that's where the court's going to be coming from. It's where the SG is pushing them. And I guess you find a great formulation for pushing an oral argument on the problem here is not that the police found the cocaine. It's that they were able to do an indiscriminate viewing of the home. It's a kilo sort of concern that might appeal to Scalia, right? It's that they're able to come into the home. She can take the cocaine out to the front porch and give it to the police. That's okay, because that's not the injury that the Fourth Amendment is trying to prevent here. It's the indiscriminate viewing by state authorities of the home. I mean, I think that's the only way you get around the information, the bank case and the snitch case and all that. Now, the third-party phone call case
is harder. I am right that it was just a best evidence thing, but
you've got to stop saying best evidence rule. As an evidence professor, it's killing me. You got to stop saying it. It's not the best evidence rule. It has nothing to do with original documents. It may be the best evidence of it, but don't call it the best evidence.
I'm trying to get the best evidence of the conversation.
There you go.
And that's really what's going on. They say, look, you know that the person, we've decided that the person who is one of the people in the call could then tell the police, could take copious notes and tell the police. It makes no sense to say and would be less protective of defendants to not get an accurate...
Well, sure it does, because then the police also find out everything else you talked about on the phone call.
I know, but the other person on the call could tell the cops that anyway. I'm just telling you how this... Look. I might not have decided the case the same way. I'm just telling you how it was.
Right. You know that that's the vulnerability, and you need some sort of good response. And the other big thing, elephant sitting in the middle of the room, is Matlock. And I'm not sure. It seems to me that implicitly your strategy is Matlock feels wrong to a lot of people. It might to these justices, even though they're more law and order than the court that decided Matlock. I mean, it would have been one thing had Matlock not been home. But they put him in the police car, and they know that he doesn't want the place searched, and they could have asked him with no problem whatsoever. And yes, you have a response to a court that thinks Matlock was wrongly decided, which is you should narrowly describe it to be simply a bright-line rule for administrative purposes, right? Yes, the police did wrong there. They should have asked him. He was sitting in the police car, but we're not going to make that sort of rule. That doesn't... But if they're... I don't know what you do if they think Matlock's rightly decided, then you lose this case, or not.
No, I think that's true. It depends on what you mean by Matlock is rightly decided. We do have this whole notion of you have an expectation that if you express your wishes, that those are going to be followed, and that looks at it through the lens of not the police conduct, but of the individual who's invoking the Fourth Amendment. And so you could still believe Matlock is rightly decided, but say that the relevant question, and as a pro-law enforcement person, that the burden is on the person who wants to protect their Fourth Amendment rights to do something, and they expect that their wishes will be honored. But if you believe Matlock is rightly decided in the sense that we want cops to win cases, then, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know that Matlock being rightly decided automatically leads to that conclusion. I think for the reason that Professor Davis mentioned, in Drayton the court says, we don't have to tell you that you have the right to refuse to give consent. And you didn't say anything, and maybe under the totality of the circumstances it might have looked like you wouldn't have given consent, but you never said I don't consent. If that means anything, it has to mean when you actually do say no. I mean, I think that makes it clearer than trying to, you know, fix Matlock in such a way that it, you know, doesn't govern this. You pretty much already set this out, Supreme Court. You said anything short of you saying, I don't consent, is fair game, because an officer could assume that, you know, under the totality of the circumstances, that you consented. I didn't coerce it out of you. You didn't say no. But when you actually do, I think that's the only thing left. Mm-hmm. And they've sort of boxed themselves in by saying anything short of you actually saying, you know, I don't consent, or in the Fifth Amendment context, I want a lawyer, anything short of that, you're unprotected. So what else is left if you don't have this?
You're not, right, I tend to agree with that. You're not saying that the police had to ask Randolph whether he consented here, right? And so if they had only asked her, she said go ahead, and he had just sat there mute, your view is the search is totally lawful, right? Maybe that's the way to reconcile with Matlock, right? He could have, Even though he's sitting in the police car, he could have said, don't you dare go into my house. And the
into, like, the megaphone.
I mean, that's the position you could do.
Attention, officer.
Calling all cars.
That's the position you've got to take, but I think it leads to, like, you know, people, basically just lawyers now, will be able to prevent people from searching. I mean, this guy was a lawyer. It's sort of funny. Of course he's saying no. He knows his rights. But it just leads to this odd situation where most people wouldn't know their rights, but that's sort of not your problem.
That's the case, right?
Yeah, that's not your problem.
Well, I do like this idea that the court has taken so much away on the premise that one thing is left, the most important thing is left. And now this is the idea that, well, we've gone this far. You know, why not?
Yeah.
Let's just take out the word unreasonable out of the... and search and see.
Mm. We see if there are any questions out there before we quit.
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering if, based on the fact that there's so many insurgency cases, current justices have sat on the court in front of. Can you, basically two questions, can you anticipate certain justices taking specific angles in their questioning? And also, do you anticipate any one of the justices or more giving you maybe a softball question? I know Scalia doesn't sometimes that I probably want you to prepare, but to try to get you on track to the point that they think is best in your argument.
I think that my best bet is, but in any event, the assumption I have to operate on is that this is going to come down conservative-liberal lines. And so that we have to, I believe, and we have to think we're going to get Stephen Souter, Ginsburg, I think Breyer, and then we've got to find a fifth vote. I think that for two reasons. Not first, just generally as a practical matter, but second, in oral argument, you can really only hope to persuade one person, I believe, in a case that's been well-briefed. So what we have to say, they've already thought a lot about and talked about with their clerks and that sort of thing. And so our justice is Justice Kennedy, rather than Justice O'Connor, because she has written an opinion that basically buys into this idea, a concurring opinion in the United States versus Carroll, that says shared space, marriage space, tough luck. Your question about softballs, that generally happens when the lawyer is not doing such a good job. So I think the answer to my question is I hope not.
can I give a just for the students' edification? Yesterday morning in second case that was argued yesterday, you may have read about it, a church's desire to use a hallucinogenic tea under a federal statute, and there was a big issue as to whether, if the federal government granted this exemption to the church to use this otherwise prohibited tea, whether it would violate a treaty. And the church's lawyer was up there struggling to demonstrate that it wouldn't violate the treaty, and Justice Scalia was really taking her to task, but she was really struggling. At one point he leans in and he says, can I make a suggestion that perhaps there's a better argument that the treaty's not violated? And she paused for a minute. And Justice Souter jumped up and said, please say yes. And she said yes, and Justice Scalia gave her more than a softball. He threw her a home run.
Uh-huh.
That also struck with me, and I think that might be a way, you're not going to necessarily win Scalia, but appealing to he's an originalist, he's an original intent kind of guy, and he's going to, if you go back to his original intent, I think that might appeal to him, because that's what he buys into.
Mm-hmm.
And it appeals to me, and, you know, I buy into that a little bit, but not.
But it's a kilo strategy.
Yeah, I remember we've heard some law comments about this.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. There are other problems,
yeah. Anybody else? All right. Thank you, everybody. Good luck, Tom.
Good job.